Travis, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Travis.
Grateful to be here and grateful to be sober today. I found a quiet room down the hall, by the way, if anybody's wanting to get in there and get some quiet time. I played with the toys. It was in the nursery. Just kidding. It was nice. Anyway, I've told my story here before, I believe. I have, for sure, a couple years ago, and also, like, a couple hours ago. You guys weren't there. It was good. You guys are missing out. Anyway, I'm grateful to be here. I really am. I have a sobriety date. It's August 24th of 2020. I have a home group, Simple Actions. We meet at United Methodist Church every Monday at 7 p.m. We are an open Big Book Step Study, so we believe in the primary purpose of helping other drunks, and we use the Big Book. I have a service commitment in that home group. I'm a GSR. If you're wondering what that is, it's kind of like the CEO, you know? You get to tell everybody what to do. Just kidding. It's the exact opposite. It's a lot of fun. I'm really big on being all in, because there was a long time where I wasn't. I came from not such a loving family. I don't know. I don't really know how to explain that. When people say, like, you know, I'm from a dysfunctional family. I don't know what a functional family really is. I mean, I know mine wasn't. Anyway, my mom was the neighborhood drunk, and she was also my teacher. She was my homeschool teacher. And I have three other siblings. I'm the middle brother. I have an older sister. And she drank a lot. And I remember my dad coming home from his 9-to-5, and he would ask me questions like, is mom drinking, you know? And I always had the smell test. Like, I was like, you know, I was like the one, the contact. And I always knew what was up. Like, if her hair was different, if her eyes were different, you could just tell. And I always knew. And I don't know what that was, but I don't know. I believe that I don't know if I was born with it. I stopped trying to figure it out a long time ago, but I think I had it long before I picked up a drink, is what I'm trying to say. I always felt different. I can't really put my finger on it. I don't know what it was that, I didn't know what it was at the time. I didn't have words for it, but I just knew that I felt very different. It was as if I was dropped off on the planet without the manual of life. I've heard people say that. And that's exactly the way it felt. Or maybe God was, you know, I was on the bathroom break when God was canning out the copies, I don't know. But it was something along those lines. And then I found alcohol, King Alcohol, at the age of 11 or 12 years old. And I was with my friends Brian and Joe, and Brian looked a lot older. He had a beard, he was a lot taller. And they went to the liquor store, they grabbed some, they brought it back. And some of that went around, some other things went around, you know, during that, at that time. And I don't know where or when it happened, but something happened. The thing that makes me bodily and mentally different from other people happened. And all of a sudden, I was okay standing where I was standing, doing what I was doing with the other people that I was doing it with. You know, that feeling just washed over me. It was overwhelming. I had never felt such peace, you know, such a calm. I've never felt so great in my life. And I wanted to have that feeling as often as I possibly could for as long as I possibly could. And I did. I ran home with my friend Joe, and Joe lived right across the street from me, and he went home, and I went to my house, and And my father wanted to know where his 12-year-old son was all night, and I told him exactly where I was and exactly what I was doing. And I didn't care. But look, I was really afraid of my dad. And not for any, he wasn't physically abusive, but I was just afraid of him. You know, I think I was born with an inclination towards being very afraid of everything and everyone. And I just had to mask that somehow. And alcohol kind of took that away from me. Or it provided me with something that I was missing, you know. And so, that happened. And I drank as often as I possibly could from that moment on. Not every day you're getting a bottle or, you know, getting a score, but I did, and a lot. I got into a lot of trouble early on. I had my first treatment center, I was 17. And none of this is a prerequisite for getting sober or, you know, being an alcoholic, but it's just, this is my story, and this is the only one I know. Anyway, my first treatment center at 17. At this time, my mother is heading into her last year of her life, and I didn't know it. I had a kid when I was really young, about that age too, with this girl that I was dating in high school. She got pregnant. I don't know if we got pregnant or she got pregnant, but I don't know which one's more offensive. But she got pregnant and had the baby. I remember being with her like in high school, and I've always had, you know, girl issues and stuff. You know, I don't know. Anyway, it was not good, and she kind of stood with me through a lot of it, what I was dealing with, what I was going through. Alcoholism is what I'm trying to say, and she left. We put the baby up for adoption, and her uncle and aunt adopted the baby. Actually, we went and dropped her off. We drove over to their house. And somewhere in New Jersey, we dropped off the baby at 3 months old and we left. And I just thought about it the other day. I was just like, you know, I'm looking at my two youngest and like, I'm even imagine like doing that. Anyway, it was tough. And then it just made for more drinking for me. You know, and then my mother died like the same year. And she died of alcoholism. I would watch her when I was a young boy. I would watch her hide her alcohol in the bushes across the street. She thought she was being slick, you know. But I would watch her like hide her 30 pack. You know, she's trying to shuffle it in there, like I don't know, like as if no one was gonna see her or know about it. But I definitely did, because I had eyes for that. I was just, you know, she'd be coming home on her three speed, like passed out in the backyard with a brown paper bag. You know, she would urinate on herself, and I would find her like that. And that was just, if you hear that beeping, by the way, it's my insulin pump. I usually make a joke and say it's my pager, but I can't. So it's all good. I'm coherent, and I'm okay. Anyway, that's just a little bit about that, and kind of to give you a rough idea of what it was like, what I was like, I guess, and that growing up in that family dynamic. Went to my first treatment center. From there, I had no desire to getting sober. I think I did hear about 12-step fellowships. I heard about maybe Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, and I didn't want anything to do with it. I didn't want anything to do with what you guys were having. I just didn't. And I kept on doing my thing. I remember convincing my dad to come pick me up out of that one, because I was still a minor, and I convinced him to come get me early. he came to pick me up, and I remember this distinctively. I remember on the way up there, actually, they had an intervention for me. I was on probation and all that good stuff, and I had a counselor, and they did a round, you know, a circle of people, probably about this size. There was a lot of people there. And I walked into this thing, and like everyone's sitting there, like my brother, my neighbor, my dad's best friend, my principal, everyone's like sitting around in a circle, and they're all telling me about my drinking, you know. And my girlfriend was there. She was pregnant. She's like this big, you know. It was crazy. And I walked in. I took one look at them, and I took off. I remember just, I don't know why. I took off my shirt and I walked away. I don't know why I did that, but I did. And I started walking down the street. I was like, "I need you, motherfucker." And it's actually my dad's best friend. He came out and he came ran after me. He's like, "Hey, Travis." He's like, "You know, you don't want to do this because you're gonna be homeless." And I was like, "Yeah, tell me what else is gonna, you know, whatever. I don't care." And then he somehow convinced me to go. And my dad already had a bag packed for me and everything in his trunk. So he put me in the car and drove me to this. I couldn't go back to the house for anything, for another fix or any of that. And anyway, I got there and I stayed until I convinced them to come get me. And fast forwarding a little bit, I got into a lot of trouble with the law. I ended up doing a little bit of time here and there, you know. I mean, I remember getting out of jail this one time, and I was on parole, and I had nowhere to go. Right? And you have to have a home plan in order to like get out of there. Like, this is in Pennsylvania, so I don't know if it's different around here, but you have to have a home plan. And I convinced my brother to, like, you know, basically put up his house in order to get me to, like, approve my parole officer to say I was going to stay there. And I go, and I'm able to, somehow I was able to get into a treatment center right after that, and that's when I was really introduced to you guys. I got to this treatment center, at that time, I had everything I could fit in a black trash bag, and none of them were mine. None of the clothes were mine, you know. I had nothing going for me. I'm on parole in another state. I'm unemployable. I have no phone and no one to call. Virtually, no one to call. And this guy came to see me. Because it was time for me to get out of this treatment center, you know, and he came to see me, because I mean, the treatment center has to like do something with you. They can't just like, a lot of the times they're not just gonna like throw you on the street. They're gonna call one of their buddies, like, "Hey, you got the halfway house? Yeah, come on over here. Why don't you just get this guy in there and he can pay you back whenever he gets a job?" Like, that's kind of how it went down, you know. And anyway, this guy came to see me, and he was driving this old Oldsmobile. It was really loud. He was from like the east side of LA. He had a lot of tattoos. He had a handlebar mustache, gray hair. He was mildly intimidating, and he whispered a lot because he was really serious, you know. I remember he came in and he asked me a couple questions. He asked me if I was willing to do any lengths for my sobriety for victory over alcohol. I lied to him and I said yes. He asked me if I was willing to take a few simple suggestions. I lied again and I said yes. And then the last question he asked me was, "Are you done?" And see, I thought he meant, "Are you done with the consequences of your drinking?" And of course I was at that time. And he said, "No, Travis, are you done trying to stay sober your own way?" And I did not have an answer for him. I didn't even know where to file that in my brain, you know? I was like, "Yeah." I don't know, I just didn't know what else to say. I wanted a free ride too, you know, I needed a place to stay. So. And that's what I did. I got a free ride and I begrudgingly went to the 12 Steps to Alcoholics Anonymous. I still didn't want what you guys had. I showed up, I didn't feel like you looked, and I didn't know why. And I would come in, I would sit in the chairs, I drank a coffee, I talked to the girls, I left 5 minutes early, I came 5 minutes late, I did all that stuff. I even worked the steps. I even shared a fifth step. I even made some amends. They were always words. I mean, there's no action behind any of them or change, but which is the whole point. But I even sponsored a few guys. You know, I don't know where, like, I've thought about this before too, like, and I don't spend much time thinking about it, but like, what I believe now, like, as working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't drink even if I could today, you know? Like, I really believe that's and the chapter, we just read it, you know? There's part of me, I really believe that. But at the time, I don't know if it was just, I was too young, or if I was, just wasn't done, I wasn't done doing it my way, or whatever. It must have been a combination of a few different things, but anyway, I was in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for 8 years, struggling and dying of untreated alcoholism. During that time, I got this, I got in a lot of trouble. That was in South Florida. I got in a lot of trouble, and they were gonna, there was only one person I could call during that time, and it happened to be my then sponsor. And I remember calling him, and I'm crying. I was just bawling my eyes out. I didn't want to live this way anymore. I didn't want to do this anymore. And you could have hooked me up to a lie detector test. I would have done anything. I would have done anything, you know? And he said, do you trust me? And I was like, I guess I have to, you know? He's like, get on this plane. I was like, well, where am I going? He goes, Baltimore, Maryland. And I was like, yeah, that doesn't sound good. this is like 2015. This is like right after the riots and everything. There was some like bad stuff going on at that time. But I went. I slept overnight at BWI Airport. Some random guy picked me up in the morning. Happened to be a friend of Bill's. He dropped me off at this. See, I thought I was going somewhere nice. he dropped me off at this homeless shelter, and I remember getting out with my bag, and I'm just like, I don't know. I was such a mess, and he's like, all right, see you later. He gets back in his car and he drives away. I was like, what's up, man? No cigarettes or anything? Like, anyway, I stayed at that place for a little over 2 years. I stayed sober. I got a bunch of knowledge about the inner workings of my mind and alcoholism and relapse and triggers and a bunch of things that have served me kind of okay today, but there wasn't the answer, wasn't the solution. It was a bunch of self-knowledge and fear, really, you know. And anyway, I ended up going back out and on my last run, and at this time, so during that time, I got some stuff back, you know. I got like a car, I even got my driver's license, I got like, you know, all these things that I didn't have, like a birth certificate, Social Security card. I even had some money at a job. I even got myself a girlfriend. And I held her hostage. Not physically, but, you know. Anyway, got with this girl, and, you know, I had some stuff. I was coming home from work one day, and my then roommate was... you know, doing their thing, drinking and smoking and whatever else, and I came in, not a cloud on the horizon, not a single thing was wrong in my life, and I had no mental defense against the first drink, period, you know. And I said, just give me that. it was actually not that bad. I woke up the next morning, the car was still in the driveway. I still had a job, the house didn't burn down, you know? And I was like, this isn't so bad, you know? And then that turned into every other day. I think I made it to like every other day as the start, and then it became like every day, and then it was like every hour, and then it was like, you know, we are making the left when I should have took the right, like, you know. Yeah, it was awful. And so that was, you know, my last run, for what I hope to be my last run, lasted 3 years. That girlfriend that I was, bless you, that girlfriend I was telling you about, she had a daughter. She was 1 year old at the time when we got together. And we started living together almost immediately, because that's just what you do, you know, when you're drinking and doing your thing. You know, I need somebody to co-sign everything I'm talking about, and I also need some validation, and I need some money, okay? And that's, she did all those things and some more. And so she endured what I was going through and what I put them through for another couple of years. Anyway, it was not good. August 24th of 2020, at this time, she was really concerned that I was going to die. And she had called a friend of mine from back home. I don't even know how, at the time, I didn't know how she even got a hold of this guy. I didn't even know how she knew him. And he came down, he drove like 6 hours to come babysit me overnight to make sure I went to treatment. Because I committed to go, I was like, yes, I'm going to go. And so, but I got to like do my thing, you know, I got to get it in. I got to go out with a bang, you know, and that's what I did. Oh man, it was awful. And I woke up, in the morning, it was actually Naomi's birthday, so that's her daughter I was telling you about. She was turning 3 that day. And I committed to staying sober, like I was going to do it. And I came to in the morning, and I was in my bed, and I had there were bottles everywhere. There was blood, and there were some other things in the room at that time. And all I could think about was where I put my stash from the night before. You know, at the foot of my bed. It wasn't at the foot of my bed. It was somewhere else. But I found it, and I did it. You know, I took it. And I ran, and I'm hearing people talk downstairs. I know they're talking about me, and it's not good. And so I race downstairs, I find my keys somewhere, and I go to run to get in my car, and I'm being tackled to the ground by that friend I was telling you about. And I still have scrapes on my knees, I swear to God. And she proceeded to grab her daughter, get in the car, and drive away. But as she was doing that, Naomi, that was her name, she was looking over my girlfriend's shoulder and saying, "What's wrong with him?" And I just always remember her saying that, like, "What's wrong with him?" And I was like, "I don't know." You know? Anyway, I went to a treatment center, and that was my last drunk. And I went to this treatment center, and 2 weeks into that deal, I had an awakening. There aren't enough words to describe to you what that was like, but what I will say is that I haven't been the same since. It's held me in good stead to this very day. However, if that was the only thing necessary, you'd have a different speaker here tonight. You know? It was 2 weeks into that thing. I remember just sitting in this room full of men about this size, and I'm coming to after this like 20-minute deal, and I had a vision, I had an awakening, and I came to, I'm bawling my eyes out in a room full of men. I didn't care. I didn't care what you thought of me. I knew that something had just happened for me, and it was profound. And if anything, what ended up happening was, see, for me, it was always like die an alcoholic death, live on a spiritual basis, or get the right job, get the right amount of money, get the right car, get the right status, the right power, whatever. fill in the blank for your own story, but I filled in every one of those. Like, if, you know, like what I was telling you, I got all the stuff back, like the stuff that I thought was like gonna serve me well and keep me sober, and none of it worked. Anyway, I had eliminated every one of those third alternatives until I was down to two. It was live on a spiritual basis or die a drug or an alcoholic death. And I think I was provided with enough willingness and desperation at that time, and they met. Enough for me to say, okay, I'll try this thing. I'm jumping all in, both feet in. And I called this guy that I had been working with. When I say working with, I mean like I'd go to his house, we'd read a couple chapters, and I'd go back out. I'd go back to his house, we'd read a little bit, I'd go back out. I just kept on doing that. But I called him and I'm like, hey Matt, I think I'm ready. And he tells me to this day, because we're still friends. I've moved on from him, but anyway, he tells me to this day, he's like, I didn't think you were ready. It's so funny, because who would have thought I was ready, you know? Like, I mean, but, you know, he was standing ready at the door, waiting for someone like me to call and say, I'm ready. And he was there and took me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I will say that I'd spent my time in that treatment center. I wrote a fourth step. I swallowed a bunch of large chunks of truth about myself while I'm writing it. Like it was, while I was writing it, I started to see, you know, how my resentments, my fears, my sexual conduct dominated me, absolutely dominated me. All I had to do is go through my phone, and if your name was in my phone, you had somehow frightened me in the past. And as a result, I was mad at you. So I just had to write your name down. And that's what I did. I just wrote, even if it sounded stupid, you know, I just wrote it down. Because here's the thing, like, alcohol is not my problem. It was never my problem. It was merely a solution, a symbol, or an answer for my problem. Because my real problem centers in my mind. I have a threefold illness. Well, two for, I guess. Physically, when I start drinking, I can't stop. I physically don't have an off switch. I can't shut it down when it should. I always seem to overshoot the mark. And I have a brain that always leads me back to it. So I have a body. I have a brain that tells me that I can, and I have a body that ensures that I can't. And I have this intense, overwhelming feeling of feeling different from everything and everyone around me. Spiritual malady. And it had a grip on me. But see, that's where alcoholism is treated at the flank, you know, on the through the 12 steps. I can't do anything about my broken mind, you know. And I can't fix my mind with the mind that created it. I mean, really, I can't do anything about my body. I can't do anything about this allergy, this phenomenon of craving that develops when I start to drink. I can't do anything about that. Just, I react differently, just as if, like, I mean, my kids at home, they have, they're allergic to strawberries. If they eat strawberries, they break out in hives. I don't, you know. Now, with alcoholism and having the allergy, we break out in a phenomenon of craving. It's kind of hard for an alcoholic, really, it was for me, to be able to see that. Because I want to prove myself an exception to the rule. We just read it before this meeting. As I was saying, I get through this fourth step, I come home, I share it with them. I had to get on a flight to get back home, so on my connecting flight, I left my sex inventory on the connecting flight, or the other flight. And I remember getting on the other flight, and I was like, oh, crap. I was like, I committed to having this done. I'm going to do it. You know, I don't want to, I'm tired of, you know, I'm tired of not matching my feet with my mouth. I'm just, you know, I was like committed. And I just, I remember having this feeling that came over me. I was like, it's okay. Maybe someone needed to see that. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe it'll help somebody or something, you know. I don't know. Or maybe I left something out. I don't know. But I didn't choose that thought, you know. And so I rewrote it. And anyway, I got home and I shared it with him. And at this time, I am convinced that me running the show is not good. I have evidence, piles of evidence that have proven this. It's right in front of me, actually, and I'm sharing it with him. And we get through it, and I felt a lot lighter. I could look people in the eyes. I walked a little bit lighter. I had my head held high. You know, I felt a little bit better. But I knew that there was more work to be done. And it came time for me to make amends. And I was 3 months sober. It was December of 2020. And I'm originally from Pennsylvania, Northeast Pennsylvania. And so I drove up there from Maryland, and I went up there to start some amends, and I'm full of fear. I don't want to do it. I think it's a terrible idea. I don't know why I'm doing it, to be honest. I just knew that what I was doing wasn't working, and I was also told, like, it doesn't really matter what you think, Travis. And it doesn't really matter what you feel, it only matters what you do. And so I was willing and dumb enough at that time to really believe that. Just kidding about the dumb part. I think I was smart for me to actually take those actions, and I did. I got up there and I said, okay, I talked to my sponsor, and I said, where do I start? And he goes, well, start with your mom. And I was like, well, she's dead. How do you want me to do that? He goes, go up to that waterfall where you spread her ashes and write her a letter. Come to find out, it says it right in the book. It says, write him an honest letter. Anyway, I did that. And I go up there. I get up, it's in the mountains in Pennsylvania. So I had to like drive this like certain way because it was during COVID. So like you couldn't go this other way. I don't know why. But anyway, I had to go this other way. And I parked in front of these like two really beautiful properties. They were like, I just, in my mind, I just remember them looking so beautiful. I think I was seeing things for the first time. I don't know. I was like a baby. Like, I'm just looking, and I'm like, oh, my God, this is so nice. There was, like, just the fence was beautiful, the tall grass. It was just, like, it was such a nice day, too, but it was wintertime. There was, like, snow on the ground. It was so awesome. And I pull up there, and I'm all by myself, and but I wasn't. Because I said a prayer. I said, God, please guide me through this. And I grabbed my coffee, and I grabbed my notebook and my pen. Bless you. And I got out of the car, and I looked over, and I saw this like little opening in the fence. It was like about the size of that trash can. It was like just enough for me to fit my body through, you know? And I was like, oh, that's me. So I wasn't thinking, like, I'm trespassing, I'm going to go to jail, these people are going to shoot me. I wasn't thinking any of that. I just saw the opening, and I was like, that's me. And so I jumped the fence, and I'm starting to walk down this, like, this creek or this stream down to the waterfall. It was like a mile and a half. I might be exaggerating, but it was not an easy way to get there. It was at least a mile. And anyway, I get there to the waterfall, and oh God, I can't tell you what that was like. It was the most powerful amends I've made so far, for sure. And it was the first one. I wrote this letter. It was not well thought out. It was like as if I'm talking to you right now. Probably within the last 40 minutes, the way you've heard me talk, that's kind of how it was. It was like, you know. And the last thing I said to my mom was, please continue talking to me through the channel of God's love. And it's the only thing I remember saying. And so I burnt the letter, I burnt my pants, and then I threw it in the waterfall. And I sat there for a little while longer. I meditated, I talked to God, I prayed. And it came time for me to get back to my car. And I started walking back, and I'm coming out of the woodwork. And actually, before I did that, there was like this giant, I'm talking giant tree. It was like the roots were bigger than this room, and it was toppled over. It was completely toppled over. And I just remember walking out and like seeing this giant tree that's just toppled over. And I just remember looking at it for the first time, like, or something like that, and actually being mesmerized by nature. Like, it was the first time that I've actually like sat there and been like, wow, I couldn't do that, you know? I couldn't make one of those things from scratch. I certainly couldn't do that. I mean, it was just insane. But I was having an experience, is what I'm trying to say. And I came out of the woodwork, and I noticed that there were these two ponds. When I first walked in there, I didn't even notice them, but there were these two ponds, and there was ducks in there, and the ducks were floating around like ducks do. And I remember I started thinking about when I was like 5 years old, my mom used to take me to this pond and I'd feed the ducks with bread, which is apparently very bad for them. And I didn't know this at the time because I'm only five. But I did that. That's what I would do. And I would love doing it. I remember, Mom, more bread. And I'd throw it in the pond. And I started seeing these ducks. And I started having this experience. I'm like, please continue talking to me. You know, that kept on ringing with me. And that's why I probably remember saying it. Why I remember saying it. And I started, you know, like, I just took out my phone. I started taking pictures of it because I don't want to forget it, you know. And as I'm doing that, I've looked back at the pictures too. I can't see them, but these two property owners are running out of their houses. They're running at me, you know. It was like very intimidating. And I don't know if they're going to, I don't know what they're going to do. Lock me up or get me in trouble or kill me. I don't know. But they came running over to me and they were telling me to like stop right there. You know, COVID, this and that, like stay where you are. And I started explaining what I was doing. I was so afraid. So I started saying like, gibbering off in the mouth, like, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, so I don't make these amends, I might die, you know, the waterfall, 2006, my mother, alcoholism, like, all this stuff was just coming out. And that guy probably felt bad for me, so he's like, go tell that guy over there. And I told that guy over there the same thing, and that guy over there told me that there were 13 cameras on his property, and not a single one of them detected me. And so as you can imagine, I was having a completely different experience than he was. You know, I was thinking, like, that's insane, because all this stuff that I just explained to you know, the stuff that I experienced, he was probably thinking like technological failure, you know, things happen, like, I don't know, who cares, you know? And he ended up talking to me about trying to get sober before, and we had talked a little bit about that, and he said, is that your car up there? I said, yeah. He's like, you usually tow people, but just don't do it again. Sorry for your loss, have a nice holiday. And I got up to my car and grabbed the caution tape off my handle, or my car handle, and the note that was on my windshield that pulled it off. And I put it in a picture frame at home. It says, do not park here again. Thank you. And I got a tattoo on my chest. Because I don't know, it was just one of those things. I drove away crying. I drove away bawling my eyes out, because I knew that something had just happened. And I was provided with, there was no more unwilling amends. You know, I was willing to make every single amends that I was consciously aware of. And that's what I did at that time. I went off and I think I made like 8 amends in like 2 hours. I was like going back to the employers, going back to the businesses, I'm paying back the money, I'm just I'm you know, doing it. And yeah, man, that's what I did. I got into sponsoring guys right away. I was told, go help somebody, you selfish prick. You know, like seriously, go and help somebody. Like, stop thinking about yourself. And that's what I did. And I've been kind of doing that ever since. The 12 steps really have changed my life. And it's changed it into one worth living today. You know, I'll touch a little bit on 10, 11, and 12 and kind of like where I'm at today. That girl that I was telling you about, we are now married. She was dumb enough to marry me. Just kidding. We have a great relationship today. She bothers me a lot, but I have a sponsor. I write inventory. I continue to write inventory because I think alcoholism is a progressive fatal illness, and it happens to center in my mind, you know. And I am, when I'm sick of spirit, my mind just fills up and I have an inclination towards self-involvement. And I'm just getting things to fix me and how I feel. It's the most important thing, you know. And when I'm doing that, things are not good. So, but it's, you know, it's important. It's very important for me to continue, you know. And continue setting right, you know, any new mistakes as I go along. I think all the 12 steps are really wrapped into that step 10, seriously. You know? It's like, I won't go through the whole thing, I don't need to. But anyway, that's what I do. I stay in 10, 11, 12. I have a strict 10 and 11 practice. I do morning meditation. At night, I do a nightly review. I share it with some people. So I can get, because I think part of it is like I have an ego, right? And it just grows back like a bad tumor. And so, if anything, when I'm sharing my inventory with somebody, or when I'm sharing my nightly review with somebody, and letting them know, like what's going on with me, and the I don't know, the selfish nature, the resentments, the fear, the amends that I made, the way I acted that day, or whatever, you know, the things I could have done better, like how many times I was thinking about myself throughout the day. It opens me up, it opens up my chest. And it says, here I am, you know? And by doing these things, I'm allowed, like I can actually be in the world with other people. And I'm not completely at odds with everyone, you know? I think there's anyway, I wanted to finish off by saying that I started telling you I got married. I have that girl that I was telling you about. She's now 7. She'll be turning 8 this year. It's so funny. Today she was like, she has this. She's really selfish. You know, she's 8 years old, so. She started complaining about her. I have 2 other kids too, so I have a 2.5-year-old and a 5-month-old. She started complaining about her younger sister, her toddler, my toddler, and she displays the same behavior every single day. But it just reminded me like how like blind I am to my own actions, you know. Sometimes like she's like, she always complains about that. She always gets what she wants. She always complains. She always cries, and she stomps off, you know. I'm like, yeah, you do the same thing, you know? But just reminded me that, like, I can't always see myself, you know? I have two kids that never see me drunk. It's wonderful. I have an employer who, by the way, I meant to say, David, thank you for asking me to come here to share. Thank you for asking David to ask me to share, I should have said. I met David in Maryland. I met him at a meeting, and came time for me to move here, and so my wife is Navy, and I remember being full of fear, not wanting to go, you know. But of course, we're at the mercy of the United States Navy, and so you kind of have to. So we came, and my employer at the time, I didn't want to leave because I was making decent money and I had a decent job, you know, and for the first time. And my employer was like, I just opened up my chest, and I was just remember being like, I don't want to go, but thanks for the ride. Like, I really appreciate everything you guys have done for me, but we're leaving in 6 months. And I got a phone call like a month later, and they were like, hey, would you be willing to work from home? To this I said, sure. I will absolutely work from home. And so that's what I've been doing. And so it's provided me with, and here what I'm telling you is that I didn't want to go, didn't want to leave my comfort zone, didn't think it was a good idea. You know, I get here and I couldn't imagine my life any better, honestly. I'm able to be there for my kids. Like, in the morning, I bring them to school and daycare. You know, I come home to a quiet house, which is really nice, and I get to work, and then I go pick them up. And I go pick them up, and I bring them home. When they're sick, they stay home with daddy. You know, I do bedtime. Like, I'm there. Like, I'm in the mix. It's not a theory, you know? And I'm so grateful for the life I live today. It's all because I was willing to take a few simple actions. Willing and desperate enough to want, I guess, what you guys had, and was willing to do it. I think I'll close there. I think I'm running out of gas. Got done talking to me, so thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Travis. Our seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Money collected at this meeting covers donations to the church and supplies. The rest is given to the Tidewater Intergroup, District 24, and the General Services Office. Are there any AA-related announcements? Okay.
Jake, an alcoholic.
Jake, hey.
Okay. We've got a workshop in our home group anniversary coming up the last Friday of April. We've got three panelists, Adita, Roger W.